Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? And does not God offer us something even better, more abundant, and eternal than worldly wisdom? This week I've been thinking a lot about Vera. I'm sad to say that I'm not sure if she is alive or dead now. Vera was hard to keep up with. She wasn't on social media. She didn't have a mailing address. But some 18 years ago, for about a year and a half, I saw Vera every single day, for she slept in the entrance to the church in which I used to work at, night after night, without fail. Often I'd see her as I was coming into work in the morning, wrapping her things up, preparing to head out for the day. And then when I would leave in the early evening, she would often be unrolling her sleeping bag, setting up the few possessions that she had for the night. Vera did not live an existence that I would wish for anyone. Like many of us, she had some mental health issues, and the church tried to make sure that she had access to and that she was taking her medicine. She had a traumatic childhood, and what was left of her family lived several states away. But despite all of her challenges, Vera was wise. She was faithful. She knew God as a friend, and she believed in the deepest way possible, despite the daily indignities that she faced, that God was looking out for her. And she was able to rest in the knowledge that she was God's beloved child. Honestly, I longed for that kind of faith in God that Vera not only relied on to get her throughout the day, but that also emanated from her to other people. And she was always in the Word of God. She always had a Bible nearby, and it was usually open to whatever chapter that she was studying, and she was very creative. She had this set of multicolored highlighters, and she could often see her highlighting things that were important to her. Her Bibles, plural, were works of art that she gave away to others. She offered to do one for me, but I just never got around to bringing her one, which I regret, because now I realize the treasure that it would have been to me. Nearly every day, she asked about Sarah and about Ellie, who was a newborn at the time. She was genuinely curious about them. She worshiped in the church as well and wanted good things for them. She was wise, and despite being a little rough around the edges sometimes, Vera was deeply kind. But then one day, she disappeared. I didn't see her in the morning. I didn't see her in the evening. And then she didn't come back the next day. And so we looked in the shelters and in the hospitals and in the morgues for her, and we couldn't find her. She was gone. I never saw her again. She taught me a lot, Vera, about what deep and abiding faithfulness looks like in a human being. Even as she lived a life that denied her dignity and was often humiliating. And in that regard, Vera was in very good company. For dying on a cross was a shameful and humiliating way to die. Crucifixion was reserved primarily for the lowest classes of the Roman Empire, and it was often employed by the empire as a tool to keep the occupied in line. The process was designed to be humiliating, and it was very effective. And when Jesus died on the cross, it wasn't just Jesus of Nazareth that appeared to be killed, that appeared to die, for the movement that he had started appeared to die on the cross with him. At time of death, save the women who were closest to him and his beloved disciple John, the few followers he had left abandoned him. And so by any logical metric, By any set of wisdom, Jesus and his mission were a failure. For when he died, the Roman Empire still occupied Jerusalem. The systems of oppression still remained in place. The donkey that he rode in on Palm Sunday into Jerusalem was returned to its owner because he had no more need of it. The palms were swept up from the street. And this movement that started in the Galilee was seemingly gone as quickly as it had begun, disappearing in an act of profound cruelty and violence that inflicted an almost unspeakable trauma on those who witnessed it, which was why the empire used it in the first place. The faith of those who seek to follow Jesus, which I'm assuming is many of us, was born in a deeply traumatic event that served as the final marker of a spectacular failure in the eyes of the world. Foolishness. Why would God, the creator of the universe, choose to enter the world in the form of a vulnerable baby, born in the middle of nowhere, and then offer himself up to die in the most humiliating way imaginable? It'd be a good question that we would do well to consider, especially most of us who are in this place today or watching online, save a few that live overseas in other lands, that most of us who live in a North Atlantic country should think about. Because in our culture, we don't celebrate losers because we want to believe we're winners. And after all, the United States, why wouldn't we think that way? We've put people on the moon. We've cured diseases that caused great harms to people for centuries. And up until about the last 50 years or so, we created economies that actually did bring people out of poverty. So why in the world would we ever follow a God who was so foolish in living and dying in such a shameful and humiliating way? Much like the middle and upper classes in Paul's little church start in Corinth, it's easy in our congregation and in our community to not really, if we're being honest, have much of a need for God, right? Very few of us want for food or housing. We're not oppressed in any real way. We've had most of our material needs met. Most people, not all, but most people within the sound of my voice haven't needed to pray the Lord's Prayer for God to provide their daily bread. So I ask again, why would we worship a God who seems to value vulnerability in such a profound way? The Church of Corinth wrestled with this too. They faced many of the same issues we face today. So Paul writes this letter to his beloved church that had already, before he had even died, made a mess of the faith that had been entrusted to them. They grew sexually promiscuous again, following the standards of the Greek life in their day. The rich had taken to eating the communion meal before the poor had a chance to eat, putting the needs of the strongest over the weaker members of their community, of the body. And so Paul begins his letter by describing the cross as foolishness, saying that God uses the cross to shame the wise. Now, those who grew up in the Greek side of town in Corinth loved attaining earthly wisdom. It was part of their great intellectual tradition. So this was no doubt unwelcome commentary from Paul. So why would he say this? There's an entire section in the Hebrew Bible known as wisdom literature that Paul was steeped in. So what's he driving at? I think there comes a time in life for most of us, if we are being honest with ourselves, when we have all of our material needs met, but we intuit at a profoundly deep level that we don't actually control all that much, that we will never know all there is to know, and that maybe, just maybe, we actually aren't self-made and we truly are not fully self-sufficient. We can't actually rely on our own strength to save us. And that whatever wisdom we found in the end is wanting. Beloved, this is where human wisdom meets its natural end and where the wisdom of God begins. Now that moment, if you've been so blessed to have that realization, is a challenge, and it's a harder challenge for affluent people like me and like most of you, who for most of their lives have considered themselves self-made and self-sufficient. It can be a crushing blow to realize that the story we've been told or the story we're telling ourselves is in fact based in a lie. Painful as it is, that moment can be a moment of great good news. It can be one of the greatest blessings in this life, because when we get to that place on our journey, we can open ourselves up to receive the wisdom of God, to realize that there is a higher power than ourselves, and that that higher power is more powerful than anything we could imagine, anything we could create, anything that we could make, and that God's weakness is more potent than any form of human strength. We should thank God for that's good news for us today, that God's more powerful than we are, that even God's weakness is more vital than our greatest strength, and that God is in the process of turning the world upside down. In that moment, we can realize that we don't have to rely upon ourselves to truly thrive in this life, because we know we can't. We realize we need God to live an abundant life, that kind of life that God dreams for us, that's marked by love and creativity and justice and generosity and service and grace. We can't do that without God. And God stands ready to help us, to give us what we need to live that kind of life. And that God is doing the same thing with our neighbor, who is made in the image of God. And even further good news is that when we get to this place, we now know where to look for the wisdom of God as found in the resurrected Jesus, who is still at work today. We can look for Jesus and meet him and his friends together as 60 of our youth and children and adults who are going on the Operation Abrigo mission trip to Juarez this week are about to do. You see, that's another piece of the good news for us. We know where to find Jesus. If you want to find him, I'll tell you where he is. I'll tell you where he likes to hang out. Jesus doesn't like to hang out, friends, in the center of society, or in the boardroom, or in the palaces of power. But Jesus prefers to hang out with those whom society tries to marginalize. Now, I'm not saying Jesus isn't in those other places. Thank God, Jesus often is, and Lord knows we need him to be there. But all it takes is a cursory reading of the gospel to see that Jesus prefers hanging out with the poor. I can tell you from my ministry experience, if you want to find Jesus and his friends, that's where you go, to the margins. For God's wisdom is found in what humanity considers to be foolish. That's why I think it's such a valuable and good thing that our Operation Abrigo trip is heading to Juarez soon. We're going to send 60 people on our behalf who will go to share the love of God by building 5 houses that are going to change people's lives. 5 houses for those whose shelter is not sufficient. It's a good thing to build those houses. I'm thankful and glad and happy that our church is a part of that work. But my prayer for the people on that trip is that they'll build more than houses. I pray that they will build relationships with those with whom they serve. And to remember, we have so much to learn from those whom we serve with. Whether that's on an Operation Abrigo mission trip or serving locally at Christ Foundry or Wesley Rankin or Project Transformation, We have so much to learn about what a fully activated faith is like from those for whom the prayer for daily bread is not symbolic, it's not rhetorical, but it is a matter of life and death. We have much to learn from these beloved brothers and sisters about what an abiding faith looks like. Now, I'm not trying to romanticize poverty in any way, but this is how God is regularly at work. And the fact that there is so much poverty in Dallas, Texas, and in the United States, and in the world, is a sin in which we are all complicit in. God's dream for the world is for every being to have what it needs, not just to survive, but to flourish. And frankly, if the world's wisdom were enough to bring the flourishing of all of God's creation, then it would have happened a long time before the life, teaching, death, and resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth. The fact of the matter is that worldly wisdom and our own strength are not enough to bring flourishing about. And so that's why God turns the world upside down in the life, death, resurrection, and ascension of Jesus. Because Jesus shows us a new way to live. And God, through Jesus, shows us how to get involved. We're not only not left alone, we're shown how to live. And we are shown how to live together. It's why we need the church. It's why you can't be a Christian and not be in a faith community. We need each other. For on our own, individually, we do not have the strength or the wisdom or the fortitude to follow Jesus the way that we even want to. But with the Holy Spirit working in and through us individually and communally, we do. So if you're not already involved in one of our four partnership ministries, I want to encourage you to get involved and participate for what you can offer and for what you can learn. They have so much to teach us that we can know no other way. So I'm praying for all of us, myself included, for our Operation Abrigo team, that we would be able to receive the gift of the wisdom of God from those whom the world considers foolish. I pray that we will each experience the joy of unexpected and unlikely friendships. So as we go through this week and the weeks to come, I encourage you to be mindful that each and every person you encounter in this world bears the image of God within them. And I pray that I will be open and that you will be open with our ears and our hearts so that we don't miss out on what God is doing. Because God manifests God's self in places most of us would never think to look. Like in my friend Vera, who slept on the doors of the church night in and night out. She was and is indeed a beloved friend of God. So may God bless the Veras in your life. And may the Spirit open us up to what they teach us today. I say all of these things to you in the name of the one who was born, who taught, who was murdered, who was resurrected, and then who ascended amongst the poor, Jesus the Christ.